Welcome to the Story Shop podcast. This is episode 3. In today's chat, I speak to Lisa Lawson, who is the founder of Deer Green Coffee Roasters. Now, back 10 years ago, you couldn't really get a good coffee in Glasgow, and then Lisa launched Deer Green Coffee Roasters, so I was particularly keen to have a chat with the person who sparked Glasgow's coffee movement. Lisa is, you can keep up with what Deer Green's up to at Deer Green on Instagram, and we'd love to hear what you think about the Story Shop podcast and some suggestions for guests. You can get in touch with us, hello at We Are Story Shop, or we're at We Are Story Shop on social media. Tell me, what is Deer Green Coffee Roasters?
What is Deer Green Coffee Roasters? So Deer Green is a company that I set up in 2011 with the purpose to roast coffee freshly, locally, and to source coffee that was well-sourced and that was single origin, and that I could supply wholesale to mainly bars at the time that I drank in. And it's evolved now to be a company where we sell online, we do barista training, we work with loads of different organisations to supply great coffee. And our main purpose is, to be in business for the better good, and to have a real purpose around everything that we do, to have a sustainable roastery, and still to source well and still to have freshly roasted coffee, but also to have more of a, we're speaking already about throwing the word ethics around. So I guess we just want to have good ethics in all we do and have that measured and improve on it all the time. Yeah.
So when you started 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So why did you start by then? What was missing in the coffee industry in Scotland?
The whole coffee industry is missing. So, there wasn't really any local roasters that were kind of true to what I had learned previously in Australia. So I roasted coffee in Australia. I went there in 1999 and left in 2002 and roasted coffee pretty much that whole time. And I got back to Scotland and there was no one doing that. And it was mainly, European-based companies with a rep in Glasgow. So the coffee was like roasted elsewhere. It's probably stale. There wasn't really a lot of science around, barista skills or roasting. There's a little bit of latte art in a couple of places around town, but really what I'd learned in the coffee culture I'd been so immersed in didn't exist in Glasgow. And it just kind of started having a presence in different cities around the world. So London had a few places, a little scene in Soho, and starting to kind of move up to like Bethnal Green and stuff like that. So there was a bit more going on, and I just thought it was time. I wasn't really happy in the job I was in. I was at a point in my life and I thought, well, if I don't give it a go, I'll probably regret it. So yeah.
And how does it feel now looking back? Obviously you talk about all these places that you've listed there, and Glasgow has now got, I would say, a great coffee scene, and you're obviously a massive driver in that. How does it feel looking back at the impact that you've been able to have?
It's kind of weird because you're so in it, you don't see it. And when you stop to think about it, there's a kind of like, wow, there was nothing and now there's loads. And there's been loads of players in that, there's been loads of people who have just been really committed to making excellent coffee, to really promoting that, being true to what they do, and just building that community. So it used to be you'd go and do like barista training and nobody in a cafe had a clue about anything, and now really there's a huge network of baristas in the city, and there's that kind of next generation of people who were baristas 10 years ago are now business owners, and it's just growing and growing, and it's great, it's brilliant.
So where do you think Glasgow ranks in the worldwide coffee scene?
Whoa. I don't know how loaded that question is. I don't know, cities are doing pretty well. It's, we're chipping into the suburbs now and more remote areas with great coffee. So Glasgow's up there as much as any other British city or a city of a similar size, I'd say.
So now you're at the stage where most people in Scotland would recognise the brand. Did you think it would get to this size when you first started?
I have no idea. I had no clue what I was doing. I had no real forward plans. I just wanted to roast coffee and I'm sort of naturally quite ambitious and I'm a hard worker, otherwise known as a workaholic. And I guess it just grew organically and I got loads of really great people around me. So I didn't really think about let's create a brand and let's grow it. I was just more about, you know, sort of is there growth year on year, because that's just a sign of continually being successful and feeling like there's a mark, there's a measure of growth and success in what you're doing. But I guess I've been lucky that social media has grown massively during that 10 years and other companies have, you know, kind of been running in parallel to mine and have all supported one another. So it's about having a community as much as about anything else to really promote who you are and what the brand name is. Yeah.
So take us back to kind of day one. What was the kind of catalyst for actually starting it?
I'd arrived back in Scotland and I'd worked in the wine industry, and then I got an opportunity to roast coffee for a wine customer, and I did that for a year in that sort of relationship, but it didn't really work out, so I wanted to move on, and I wasn't getting paid a lot, and I was kind of kickstarted a wholesale coffee roasting business for someone that didn't know anything about coffee, so it was quite demoralising. And I got a bit frustrated and I literally just Googled secondhand coffee roaster, and there it was on the screen, clicked buy, put down a deposit on a credit card and had to find, I had to find 24,000 within like 28 days to pay for it. I got laughed out of the banks because apparently you can't just go in and get a business loan, which I didn't really know at the time. And so I had like three private loans in the end, and the coffee roaster arrived, and I whacked into a little old design studio that was down next to the Clutha by the Clyde. That was it. Roaster arrived in January 2012, and had no idea what I was doing, and just, you know, got friends to help me plumb it in, friend to help me build a counter. My first desk was like breeze blocks and a bit of plyboard. It's all very basic. My grandparents' house was just being emptied at the time, and I just repurposed lots of things, furniture and whatnot, my grandpa's toolbox and all sorts of stuff just to help me get started. So literally on a shoestring. And cycled around town delivering kilos of coffee to, I think, six original customers that were originally wine customers that
So they were the people you knew at the start, and then they immediately came over. Yep. And how did you start to grow? Was it word of mouth?
Word of mouth, definitely. And then it just really kicked off, and I couldn't control it. I was literally out of control. Every year we were doubling our sales for the first few years. My friend came to work with me. So every year we sort of had one more staff member. So it was very much organic in terms of staff. And the sales kind of plateaued after a few years when we finally moved premises and got organised. But really, it was a fighting fire since day one. And it was because coffee was gaining popularity, as much as people were like, you're the only guys in Glasgow doing this. So, it just grew from that point.
So did you feel there was a lot of education to do with a lot of people when you were first speaking to them about why to come to get coffee from you as opposed to anyone else?
Yeah, very much so. People didn't understand what I was doing. They're like, you roast what? they didn't really understand what coffee was. Or you have a cafe, and I'm like, no, it's a roastery, we roast coffee. So, you know, just the word coffee, people presume it's a cafe. So just about what we were doing, we had to educate, sort of telling people that coffee wasn't Italian. And then supplying the coffee and insisting we did barista training. And that was our USP, that we trained scientifically and really showcased what espresso could taste like, and not just about putting latte art on a really badly prepared espresso, really focusing on flavour, on quality of flavour, really talking to people about the process that coffee had gone through at origin, that it's a cherry picked from a tree, going right back to basics. So bringing the education of the like agricultural side of the coffee and the supply chain and the flavour to bars and cafes it was supplied. And just grew from there.
So you've mentioned a lot about the kind of the supply chain and the ethics. Talk me through the kind of difference between an unethical coffee roaster and an ethical coffee roaster.
I don't want to usually... you're trying to get me to like someone.
A hypothetical unethical coffee roaster.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, coffee is trading stock market, has a commodity price, and there's lots of coffee. It's completely untraceable. That is just a price. You're not necessarily going to know where it's from. It might be generically from a country like Brazil. Brazil's huge and it has a huge production of coffee. So a lot of coffee is completely untraceable. You don't really know what a picker or a producer, how much money they've made from that, if anything, really. So if you're buying a coffee, it literally just says Brazil. You're probably not buying an ethical coffee. If you're buying one that has information about the producer, the farmer, the origin, the region, the altitude, the harvest season, what date it's roasted on, it's more likely to be ethical. But at the same time, it's not always foolproof. So, you know, just if you're a consumer buying coffee, you should just try and find out as much information as you can. A roast date is always an indicator you've bought from a local roastery generally, or someone who cares about the sensory experience of the coffee, that it is fresh. And naming the farmer doesn't mean everything, because a lot of roasteries just kind of regurgitate the information that you give them from an importer. So it depends how much every roastery, how seriously they take it. And we like to think we take it pretty seriously at Dear Green, and buy sustainably. So we buy from the same producers every year, so they have an onward income. We always buy from them. So yeah, it's hard. There's lots of different angles to look at it.
I know visiting producers has been a big part of the business. Mm. When did you first do a producer visit?
The first coffee farm I went to was actually in Hawaii in the year 2000. I went to the Hawaii Kona Coffee Festival. And that's the first time I really saw the process. And that's when I worked in Australia. As Dear Green, the first place I went to then was in 2013, I believe. And that was a trip, flying into Mexico, travelling overland through coffee farms in Guatemala and flying out of Antigua, Guatemala City. So taking in lots of farms across different regions, different altitudes, smallholders to huge industrial farms that had loads of investment. So really saw loads there. And then since then, been to Ethiopia, Kenya, Rwanda, Burundi, Colombia, Brazil, and just really kind of wanting to see or have an experience of the logistics, the style of farms in each region, having a better understanding so that we can source better. I don't really feel I need to go to too many other places. We're kind of thinking about our carbon footprint and reasons to travel and making sure we always travel with purpose. And I feel like we have had a purpose with everywhere we visited, and I kind of want to pass that education on to the team as well, so everyone in the team can go to Origin on behalf of Dear Green if they'd like to, and they have that experience and they can bring that education back as well.
So what do you learn when you go on these trips? What's the kind of biggest takeaway for you?
It's interesting because every trip's been different and it's been with different people quite a lot of the time. Been stuck in a 4x4 with someone for a week, you learn a lot about them and their business or their part in the supply chain. So you'd be travelling with exporters, importers and other roasters sometimes. You really learn about different farms, and initially you're learning about the process, you're learning about the seeds, you're learning about how a coffee cherry is picked. It's pulped, it's fermented, it's dried. You're learning about how you can add quality and to the flavour through how that entire process is controlled. And also just witnessing how happy workers are and feel comfortable that you're buying through the right chain. So for me, that's been priority, and in witnessing their systems and what they have in place for like welfare or real basics that we take for granted here, like there, that would be like international labour law, as opposed to us having a full-blown UK system through having a more organised infrastructure here in government. They don't have that in a lot of developing countries where coffee's from. So it's about really feeling comfortable where we're buying from, and I don't think I ever will. So that's why I've always wanted to bring ethics into everything that I do.
And is there a particular memory or experience that stands out from any of these trips?
Oh my goodness, so many. it's hard to say, really. I mean, just remember being in rural Rwanda, and there was people there that had never seen a white person before. They just hadn't seen a car before, maybe. And they're just like running after our car, and the kids with like no shoes on, threadbare clothes. So hard. And trying to, I don't know, sort of quantify these experiences, and that is their normality. In actual fact, they're really happy. They don't have complications like we have. We have so much here, but not everyone's happy because of that. Mm-hmm. It really makes you feel extremely lucky. There's just like, but you can't judge, it's so unfair. The distribution of wealth in the world is so unfair, and you really see that with your own eyes. I famously cry every time I go to Coffee Origin, and they're like, oh, there she goes again, you know, like, so it's, I find it really hard going, but I have to have that reality check because of what I do. There's so many stories like that. I mean, there's heaps of stories like that. I don't even know where to start.
People don't really equate those two things. Like, when people are just drinking their coffee, they're really just thinking about drinking their coffee and not really thinking about, and that's been a big part of what you've done, is educate a lot of people and change things. So so tell me about a regular day in the life now.
My alarm clock goes off. I get up and I make an AeroPress coffee, and I put it in a keep cup, and I dash out to work, and we have a morning meeting at the roastery, and then the roaster goes on, and I'm generally kind of just checking in with all of the team and seeing what they're doing. There's 7 of us at the moment at Deer Green. Some days I'm doing QC with the roaster, so tasting all of the coffees we've roasted this week, or doing a buying decision with the roaster. So I'm quite involved in the quality control, checking in with maybe our wholesale manager to help him problem solve anything with customers, or having a conversation about how we can add value to what we do, or always updating processes and procedures and finding efficiencies in what we do. So I kind of like overseeing a lot of that kind of side of the business, and thinking of social media updates or like topics that we want to promote, or we're really excited to be part of the B Corp movement, and always having our finger on the pulse of what's going on, what information is coming down the line from there, or from what's the current topics in the coffee industry, and keeping our finger on the pulse with all that kind of stuff as well. So always lots going on, and always a huge to-do list every day.
And so you mentioned there about the team. You've obviously got, we're next door neighbours, so yeah. I've met most of your team, and they're all great. How do you go about hiring and finding the right people?
We've been super lucky. We've always had really good staff retention. Got a really lovely team, and whenever we've kind of interviewed anyone or hired anyone, it's always be like someone who's got a can-do attitude, someone who's personable, someone who fits, really, and someone who gets excited by coffee. And from there, then it's just about learning what we do and how they can fit into the team. So I think now we're a bit more we'll hire for a set role and have everything documented a bit better. But in the early days, it was like, are you a cool person? Great. Do you like coffee? Can you drive? Are you really fast at packing coffee? And can you lift a 60 kilo sack? You know, so back in the day it was a bit more like that. And what can you turn your hand to? Now we're have a bit more of a like definite job roles.
And that you said the first person you hired was that a friend, did you say, or your friend was just helping you?
Yeah, my friend was on maternity leave, didn't wanted to go back to her job, and you know, soon after maternity leave, realised she didn't really want to work where she'd worked previously, and I was like, help, I'm so busy, come and help me, and she did. So so she's been with the company for 8 years, which is pretty cool.
And it's something that you get, like, we hired a friend and we got a lot of advice, don't hire friends. Yeah. You know, what would you say to people who say that?
Oh, I guess it's different. You might hire one friend and not another, you know.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I always think it's like, don't hire someone just because they're a friend.
Yeah.
Hire someone because, you know, and I think it does strengthen it. Like, we've certainly found since bringing someone in who was a really close friend that they do care more, and they care more about it, and you know they're good at the role you're bringing them in for. But I think where people maybe go wrong is when they just hire someone and they're just a friend and they don't really have the skill set to back it up.
Approach it with care. I think we went through a little process. We've had like 3 meetings. We actually presented the pros and cons of working together, and we'd written down exactly the same things because we knew each other inside out. But we had lived together, we had travelled together, we went holidays, we kind of like did a lot. You know, if you know you can be in someone's company and not really fall out, and have the same, I guess it's having the same outlook, isn't it, as well, and maybe the same work ethic and stuff, then you know it's going to fit.
Yeah, work ethic's a big thing.
Yeah.
How do you manage that? That's something you mentioned earlier about, you know, being a workaholic, and that's something that's quite hard. You know, I think it's a blessing and a curse as well, that it is quite hard to get away. Mm. How do you kind of balance that?
Yeah, I think I've always, you know, worked hard for other people. So, you know, I've worked as a chef and done like split shifts, and but really loved food, and that's why I did that job, and worked in wine, and then always went to like staff wine tastings out of hours. I've always been someone who's done extra, I suppose. So when it's your own company, you don't mind. You're happy to put in that extra. And when you're doing something you love, like, Dear Green's a passion project originally, and it's worked out. It's grown arms and legs, and now we've got a team and we're like a proper company. So, yeah, there's always a learning curve in a company, and I always, you know, I'm not going to go home and read a novel. I'll probably go home and read a blog on another, business or profile case study or something, so I can learn from it. Like, that's just where my interest level is. So I'm interested in just always doing things better and learning. And one day you're learning about HR, the other day you're learning about environmental awareness, or or a new coffee that's out, or reading about, you know, someone else is talking about a different brew method, or I just find it really interesting. So to me, it's not always work. So they say, if you do something you love, you never work a day in your life, but you probably do work even harder.
Well, wasn't that interesting? I can't wait to hear what they say next. If you're looking for something for your eyes to do while you're listening to this fascinating interview, why not visit our website at wearestoryshop.com. There you can do it all. Sign up for our newsletters filled with witty commentary, read all the lovely things our clients have to say about us, meet the team, and find our social media channels so you can keep up to date with all the stories we're telling. That's wearestoryshop.com. Now back to the interview. So are there any, like 10 years, there must have been some mistakes or things that went wrong. What kind of stands out?
That's tricky. I suppose the pandemic has been a good learning curve, as like traumatic as it was on like the 20th of March 2020. Since then we've learned an awful lot. So as a company we're leaner, and you know, we've done loads of stuff over the years that they've not necessarily made us any money, or they've been a bit of a waste of time, distracted us from stuff we could have or should have been doing. So I guess looking back, I'm like, what was that? I've done loads of events and I don't regret anything that we've done. But maybe that time could have been put to better use, or
It's hard to quantify that, because I imagine, you know, if say imagine the Coffee Festival and things takes an unbelievable amount of work, but and it's hard sometimes quantify the kind of brand loyalty that people will have to you because of that, because you're the people behind that, and weighing that up at the time must be quite difficult because there's immediate things to do.
Yeah, for sure. Like, you know, like the Coffee Festival, we've always kind of bankrolled the Coffee Festival every year, and it's not to the benefit of Deer Green. It's, you know, we've done it for the benefit of the local coffee community and to grow the local consumer base, I suppose. But then, you kind of think, oh, well, I could have used that time to invest in my team, or, you know, like, there's just different ways of looking at everything you do. But, I don't think, there's nothing stands out that we're like, oh, that was awful, we shouldn't have done that. I guess the more you go down your journey, you're like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have travelled as much. When I'm really thinking about now, we're doing our measuring our carbon footprint, so things start being highlighted to you, and then you look back in retrospect, but not major regrets. Like, I think probably I'd wish I'd outsourced a few other things and not just trying to do everything in house. And you know, there's so many people that are better at doing things than us that I could probably tap into earlier. But then we wouldn't have grown as organically and as sustainably, possibly.
Authenticity is a big part of, I think, why people have kind of resonate with Deer Green, because of the authenticity. And it's hard because obviously you're taking on a lot to make it so authentic, but then it's quite a hard balance to strike.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So 10 years now, you said you had no plan for the first 10 years. Do you have a plan for the next 10 years?
I guess so. It's a secret.
No, like, I don't. What would you be happy? Like, that's the thing. I've certainly found since starting a business, there's like no time that you're like, I'm happy. You know, I've made it, I've done this. You know, it's always. What would you be happy with in 10 years?
I guess, you know, I think we've spent through B Corp certification, we've learned an awful lot, and continuing on that journey is something that really excites me. So, you know, we've got like impact reports to write, and we want to increase our score, and by increasing your score, you're actually adding a lot of value to all the processes within the company, to do with staff, customers, stakeholders, community, environment. So just by having this assessment in place that we can tap into and learn from, I find that really exciting. I'd love to have a carbon neutral roastery. I'd love just for us to be able to do a lot more training and have a lot more face-to-face contact again, because we've not had that for so long, and we're trying to protect the roastery for so long. You know what it's like, we're like, don't come in. We can't risk having a positive case on site. We don't want to be out of production or be a risk to the team, so, you know, not having that hanging over us in the foreseeable future would be really lovely, just to be able to relax a bit. And I think this is the year, actually. I really feel excited, and as a turning point, I feel optimistic for the year ahead. Less uncertainties, or if there are, we're just more resilient and be able to deal with them quicker.
I think for every business, if you can't, it's very hard to plan ahead when next week three people might go off with COVID, or, you know, it makes it a real challenge. I think it's great to actually, hopefully, getting towards some certainty where you can start to think about that. So you mentioned the B Corp there. What would you say to other businesses who are thinking about maybe looking at a B Corp?
Do it. I have no hesitation. I've learned so much from it. You know, I was already in the zone of, I guess we've always liked to do things right. It's better to be good than be bad, you know, like, and I didn't know this existed until I wrote up our ethics page on a website, updated it, and someone mentioned, oh, you should go for B Corp, and I looked into it, and I was like, oh yeah, we could totally, we do that, and we do that, and we do that, you know. So then I started doing the assessment, and not only was I able to pass it with a lot of practices and procedures we already had in place, but I learned so much from it, and I've got so much to learn, and it opened up this whole other world that I didn't know existed, of people that are just really supportive, that are willing to help us through the next phase. So, and it's just about doing business better. So whether that be the welfare of your team, whether that be environmental decisions, financial decisions. Like, it's just, yeah, so helpful. A real, you don't even have to pass, you know, the audit. Just do the assessment and learn from it.
Mm-hmm. And is that other B Corps that you've kind of formed a community with that you're learning from?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's actually a kind of like online space, of course. There is for everything, isn't there? So and it's called the Beehive. It's sort of like, you know, Facebook for B Corps, and you can all chit chat. And it's really cool. It's really nice to have that resource as well for the business, because, you know, it's lonely being a business owner sometimes. You don't have like someone sort of saying, oh, well done, and what are your KPIs and what are your targets, and you've achieved them, excellent, you know, like. And I feel like you kind of have this support network. It's like having a business mentor, or, you know, I think if you're a business owner, you kind of need to have that. Mm-hmm. So for me, I've just found that, especially because I did the assessment during lockdown, then I've just really found that really, really helpful. Mm-hmm. It was like a light at the end of the tunnel for me. So
you mentioned kind of mentors and things like that. Did you, when you first started, were there, who did you go to? Because you started it by yourself, and who did you turn to for advice and at the beginning?
I think I just tapped into a lot of like friends that are maybe like freelancers or self-employed, and a lot of them maybe like were like artists or, you know, or doing something IT, or, and, you know, just really inspired by someone being able to create their own income without having a boss. So initially it's just learning the, you know, real basics of like tax and things like that that you need to know when you take that path. But then as I moved on, I suppose it was really connecting with other coffee roasteries around the world, or like not in Glasgow, maybe in London-based businesses. And in Glasgow, there's one particular person I was in touch with. They bought my coffee. I asked them about business mentors. They ended up becoming my mentor after recommending someone else. And then I just took coffee round to an office in Glasgow the first Wednesday every month and got an hour of this person's time, and it was like learning about my first end of year accounts, like, what does it all mean, you know? And it was just taking each step like that. And as you go through different phases, like, I've had someone help me find premises, or I've had someone else maybe help me with product development. You have different mentors for different topics that are maybe you're focused on each time and the development of your company. So, yeah.
And how have you approached finding these people?
I don't know.
They just come to you?
They just come. Yeah. Yeah, I guess it's like you put the good vibes out, you get them back a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Or tap into your network and see who knows who and what could help you.
And you mentioned some of the businesses in London, things like that. Who do you look to as you think someone who's doing coffee really well, apart from yourself?
I guess all like kind of first players in the UK. It's like Square Miles, an obvious one, and has been. We're probably the first ones. When I started out, there was Small Batch and Extract. I mean, there were hardly any really in the UK. And they're all the kind of first to market in the UK. So you kind of, originally I'd always be looking to see what they were doing. And, you know, like Square Mile kind of influenced the name of Deer Green as well, because it's like geographical nickname, quite simple, just two words. And and when I spoke to Annette, who's one of the founders of Square Mile, she said they were influenced by Stumptown. So that's the nickname for Portland, mm-hmm. where they're based in the States. So I guess like, I've, you know, Blue Bottle's another one in LA, and I worked for Toby's Estate in Australia, so they're a big influence as well. They were a startup. I was their first employee, and then they were just like massive, and they're kind of multinational now. So it's just following what others have done and looking to see what they're doing and how you can learn.
And do a lot of people get in touch with you for advice if they're starting out?
Yeah, I've had that quite a lot. I'm an authorised trainer for sensory skills for the Specialty Coffee Association. So I've had other roasteries come to learn sensory from me. before they've started up, which has been quite flattering, I suppose, in a way that people want to learn. Just generally asking about, you know, the classic sort of questions about how to install a roaster.
So is it mainly quite functional things they want?
Yeah, a lot of the time there's like technical conversations going around, and I started a WhatsApp group with different roasteries in the UK as well, so if anyone has a bit of an issue then it usually lands in that group and everyone helps one another. Got John Thompson, who's an incredible coffee professional who has a lab and is based in Edinburgh, and he's incredible and we're so lucky to have him in Scotland. So Coffee Nexus, based in Cannon Mills. So I've learned a lot from him, and he's a great guy. So there's loads of great people in the industry that'll always help, and yeah.
So something we ask everyone that comes on is about one business you love. So I'll put you in the spot.
Okay. One business I love. I think this past year I've been particularly inspired by Beauty Kitchen, and they are a local company that make beauty products, so like face creams and all that kind of stuff, and they are B Corp. So when I achieved a B Corp certification, I was immediately connected to them. I think they're based in Wishaw, and I have just found Jo Chidley and her husband Stuart so inspiring. And during COP they set up a circular economy hub on Sucky Hall Street, and they used that as a hub for B Corps to come together. So any B Corps that were coming to COP 26 in Glasgow went to, you know, this incredible space. And they have actually, I mean, what they do is pioneering in the beauty industry, and they're just based down the road, and they're the highest B Corp score in the world for a beauty company. And they're just a couple of miles away, and I'm just blown away by what they have achieved. It's incredible. So yeah, super inspiring, and they're on my radar right now to look to anyone. So I'm looking at them for like sustainable packaging inspiration, and just the way they operate their business is, yeah, like really inspiring at every level. So yeah. Check them out.
get your face cream. Businesses like that, and why, you know, you never get to that stage where you're ultimately happy, because there's always someone doing something a bit better that you can learn from and everything, and it's great. So if you weren't in coffee, what would you be doing?
Oh, it'd be something food and drink related. Definitely, it's all I've ever done. So I've worked in hospitality since I was 14. And
what was your first hospitality role?
first ever job was making sandwiches at a cricket club. And then I worked at a local golf club for 5 years. Even when I went to uni in Edinburgh, I came home at the weekends to work in this golf club. And I worked in various like fine dining restaurants as a chef in Edinburgh. Then I went to Australia, did coffee, came back, worked in wine for 6 years. So,
and did you go to Australia to do coffee, or was it?
No, I just went to Australia to hang out. Yeah.
And did you love coffee before you went to Australia, or?
Yeah, I think I started drinking coffee to get me through split shifts during Edinburgh Festival when I was working as a chef, and then it's funny, I do remember having my own grinder and buying whole beans and grinding them freshly, even when I was a student, but I knew nothing about it. And there was no resources, there was no internet. So there's nowhere to learn, there were no books. Amazon was just new. And yeah, so there was just nowhere to learn about coffee. So it wasn't really, there was no information in front of me, and I didn't look for it. So it wasn't until I got to Australia, and I guess already was obsessed by flavour, and had a sensory ability based on chef skills, and randomly got this job packing beans in this guy's garage in the red light district in Sydney, and his mum's garage, and a 5 kilo probat, and I was like, wow, that coffee smells different from that one. And yeah, so I just got completely obsessed from day one.
And you were 3 years, you said you were there?
Yeah.
And what size was the company? It was just few people?
I was the first employee, yeah.
And when you left?
Maybe there was about 30 of us or something. And yeah, and then I think in about 2010, the company was sold to Cerebos, who own like Saxa Salt and Morris Bowmore and all this kind of stuff. So incredible success story that they spread all across Australia and then moved into, I think, like the Philippines, Indonesia. They opened up in New York as well. So, yeah, did incredibly well and were, you know, really well known in the coffee industry as well. So huge inspiration for me. I was like, wow, I was right at the start of that. So
having a front row seat and seeing everything I did right and probably a few things not so right as well. So what was the kind of biggest takeaway from what they did?
I think just knowing that you can do it. Just get a roaster and buy some raw beans and roast coffee and find customers. Just seeing that that is a possibility, that you see that, you know, if you see a company doing that, you're like, oh, wow, how could you even start that? It's just too complex. But when you see it really from really raw at the beginning and in actual fact and you realise people are just winging it, then you realise you can too.
It's a big eye-opener. And how do you step away from work now? You mentioned obviously that you're always thinking coffee, but what else do you do to kind of try and sometimes get away from coffee?
I suppose I go running and I do yoga. I like to cook. Listen to music. Radio 6 plays a large part in my life, really. Yeah, to switch off, I love to cook, to be honest. I mean, even if I'm not hungry, I'll just like chop things up to ferment.
I never realised you worked, I knew the wine part of it, but I never realised you worked as a chef. Where were you working?
I don't even know if half these restaurants exist anymore, but in Edinburgh was my main chef time, and I worked for Tony Singh, actually, who people would know these days. I think he maybe writes in Scotsman column. I don't know what he's doing now, but he was awesome. He was great. I worked for him in a restaurant called Martin's in Edinburgh, and I worked in the Atrium. I worked for Howie's, which still exists, but not any of the original restaurants I worked in. Various other places around Edinburgh. And I came back to Glasgow and I worked in Fusion, which was the first sushi bar in Byers Road, first sushi bar in Glasgow. I think it's now the Bee Curry Shop or something like that. Various places, but yeah, Glasgow was a bit chips with everything. So I just, that kind of put me off chef, and when I moved back to Glasgow, then I went to Australia and came back and yeah, decided I wouldn't chef anymore. But it set me up with really good skills for life.
Work ethic for a chef.
It's nice to know you can cook for the rest of your life. Yeah. Everyone should just work as a chef when they're younger and cook nice food for the rest of your life. Yeah.
So what's your go-to meal?
Oh, I guess I just get influenced by different things. Went through a tagine phase. I don't know. What was my current phase? I don't know. Yeah, I'm really into I've been obsessed for a couple of years now by the Noma Book of Fermentation, just ferment everything. I get an organic veggie box at the weekend and I can never eat it all, so I just chop it all up and ferment most of it and experiment with things. Yeah.
So last question, apart from Glasgow, where's the best coffee scene then?
Oh, that's tough. Places I haven't been to yet. I think I'd really like to go to more places in Asia because that side of the industry is really kicked off, really developed, like Hong Kong maybe, or Tokyo, some major cities probably in Asia I'd want to go to. Sometimes I just feel completely underwhelmed when, you know, you go to somewhere in London, it's got thousands of Instagram followers and hundreds of likes on posts. And then you have a coffee and you're like, oh, it's actually no better than one you might have here. And it's just by default, if there'd been no more people who are going to like things in that street or like, you know, that area. So, yeah, it's interesting. Like, I try not to follow too much of what's going on in social media, but just pick up on what other people are talking about, where they've been, people in the industry maybe, where they've been and where they had a nice experience. A lot of it's about customer service and atmosphere, and there's a lot of great coffee out there. So
that's the biggest thing I find. That's why I find love the coffee scene around Glasgow. It's because you go in and the people are really nice, and you know them all, and you feel invested in their success as well. So
And the psychology of you then taking that sip of coffee is completely different.
Definitely. Oh, well. Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. No, it was great. That was a little escape from the Rose Street today. Wonderful. Thanks.
Thank you very much for listening. If you know a purpose-driven entrepreneur with a story worth telling who would make for a great guest on the Story Shop podcast, send us a message on social media. We're at We Are Story Shop on all channels.